Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everybody. Or I should say good morning. I keep saying good afternoon. Actually, it's good morning. It's 10:30. And this show is called Old and New, and my name is Keith Brabender. And today I'm going to talk about the topics of interest for 2016. There's just some things I want to comment about. So I'll be covering a variety of different things. I'd like to remind you I have a novel on Amazon called A Deserted Place. You can get it on Kindle or in paper. And I have a book of poetry called The Summit of Things. You can get it under my name, Keith Brabender, or you can get it under the name of the books, A Deserted Place and The Summit of Things. What I want to talk about first of all today and get right into the subjects is I want to talk about this Zika virus. All I want to say about it is if you watch the television shows about these different outbreaks and you see the way in which diseases and these various problems are discussed, it's very understandable why it is that some people have very little faith in what they hear. Because there was this immediate announcement that all of these children had severe, you know, defects from the Zika virus. Encephaly was the made your brain smaller, and it was a terrible defect. And that there were like 3,000 children that had it and all this kind of thing. And now there are reports out that, well, maybe this is just a coincidental thing and maybe it really isn't the cause and they don't really know. And if you get this disease as an adult, it generally isn't that serious and it doesn't do anything. But yet, the people who run the Olympics, and the Olympics is going to be in Brazil in 2016, are telling athletes that if they feel uncomfortable not to come. So all I'm saying is there's a lot of people who have a lot of suspicions about the way in which the health organizations report these things and the way they're treated in the press. And I have a feeling if the Zika virus works its way through, it may actually lend itself to that more than it would be for us to have a trustworthy feeling about everything we hear. And this is not good. It's very similar to, if I can make a kind of an odd analogy, but it's what I always remember. When I was a kid, radio stations used to have these, what they called tests on the radio to announce a nuclear war. They would have a siren or a beep come on, and they would have an announcer come on and say, "This is only a test. We are testing the fail-safe system for the United States, and this is only a test." And so you would hear this beep and this voice all the time. It's like crying wolf. Well, eventually the thought was that one day if you heard this on the radio, you wouldn't think it was the real thing because you've been hearing tests done all the time since you were 5 years old. And if you listen to these tests for 5, 10, 15, 20 years, they really wouldn't mean much to you after a while. You just wouldn't pay much attention to it because they do this every couple weeks and they want to make sure that the system works. The health organizations need to be more careful, and this goes across the board. You know, you read an article on a Monday and coffee's really, really bad for you, and then you read another article on Tuesday and coffee's really, really good for you. And then you read another article where it's bad to drink, and then another article where red wine is really great for you and beer's good for you. It's just it can be very confusing. And in the end, what happens in these cases, if people don't panic or follow what's going on, they'll just do what they want, and they're not going to pay any attention to it. Now, I want to very quickly get to Donald Trump because this is the conversation within the Republican Party now, in my opinion, and I have, been involved with it off and on for a little while about what's really going on within the Republican mind. And what's going on now is a math problem. The Republican Party is trying to figure out the math, this whole thing. they're trying to figure out whether it's actually mathematically certain that Trump would win the nomination, even if he wins the primaries. Because when he won the New Hampshire primary, Mr. Trump, for the Republican Party in primary, he only won less than 40% of the vote. So he didn't win a majority. And you have to go state to state, and you have to go around and figure out what states give all their delegates and what states give a partial. And what the Republican Party is going to try to figure out is whether or not, even if he wins the primaries technically by getting, say, 35% in every one, will he still win the nomination? Because it's very possible that he will go to the convention, in theory anyway, without a majority of the delegates, because there's a group of delegates in the party that don't have to vote for him. I think they're superdelegates. Each party has them, and they can vote the way they want. It's a fairly large block. So if you do it that way, it's a very interesting math problem. What many people have argued is the Republican Party needs to call in party discipline. They need to have a meeting of some kind, and what they need to do is they need to figure out who they want as the alternative to Donald Trump, and they need to call up everybody else and tell them to get lost. But apparently this is not how the Republican Party is working, or they can't, or the delegates aren't cooperating. And this is a very interesting problem for the Republican Party, because it's in a quandary. It wants to look as if it has an open and free primary. It wants to give the appearance that when people pick a candidate, as they are picking Mr. Trump, that's what the Republican Party really wants to do. It wants to be able, within the context of the primaries, to be able to say, okay, we had an open primary, Mr. Trump was at the debates, he told people what he thought, and he got elected. But on the other hand, the Republican Party is like any other organization. It wants to actually have the person elected that it wants elected. It's no different than any other organization. It may pretend it wants a free and open primary, but it really wants the person that it thinks will win, and it wants the person that it thinks will represent the party in the best way. And it's very obvious to me that this is not in the opinion of the Republican Party, is not Donald Trump. But they're doing the math. And I think if they had to pick somebody to be the candidate as the alternative to Donald Trump, I don't think they know what to do. And I think this is a very serious problem. I don't think Kasich has got the wherewithal to be a national delegate to beat Hillary Clinton, but I think that Rubio and Mr. The other candidates have enough oomph, as it were, to win either, particularly since there's a serious problem with the way in which the Republican Party now is trying to present itself to the public. Mr. Cruz, Ted Cruz. That's the guy I was thinking of. Mr. Cruz now is written about endlessly as trying to appeal to the evangelical vote. This is not what the Republican Party wants. It doesn't want an evangelical candidate. Mr. Rubio is having problems because he's now seen as a stumbler, and he's seen as somebody who's being manipulated, and he's not a person of his own mind. And the rest of them, Bush, Carson, is just isn't there. Mr. Bush has got too much baggage, as I've talked about, and Mr. Carson's just a weak candidate. They don't know what to do, but that would be the math that they would want. You get rid of everybody, you pick one person, and that person, because if you add all the votes up from all the other candidates, if those people would vote for the candidate of the Republican choice and not vote for Trump, they would have the majority. And what happens in every primary at some point in time is it's no longer a test of wills, and it's no longer a test of morality or intelligence or anything else. It's a math problem. This is exactly what happened to Hillary Clinton when she ran against Barack Obama. He won the math. And there were lots of articles about the fact that her campaign never truly understood how the math worked. They thought there were a lot of winner-take-alls, and there weren't, and Obama kept accumulating delegates and pieces, and it just they didn't understand how this went. You got to have somebody in your campaign who can sit down and do the math. Now, the other thing I want to mention about the election, and I'm going to mention this in passing, but I think it's important to mention, and that is that 911 has never been a truly under discussion in this campaign. And the man that I always quote about that is Paul Craig Roberts, a person that used to be working the Treasury Department for Mr. Reagan back in the 80s. And he made I heard an interview with him on radio. I don't want to take credit for saying this, but I thought it was very true what he said. He said that the entire foreign policy of the United States and the outlook of the United States is run by the fact that the 911 story has never been officially debunked. It's still held on to. And as long as we think 9 or 18 or however many were Muslims who were alcoholic potheads could blow up two towers on their own in airplanes and bomb and destroy Building 7 who never had anybody hit it, if we still think that's true, then we'll go around killing everybody. And what Paul Craig Roberts said was, if we don't argue about this, then nothing will change. And my point is, this goes back to one of my subjects I've talked about very often. This is the myth that the United States is holding on to. Countries have stories that they keep, and it's one of the defining aspects of what makes them what they are. The Japanese have their version of what happened in World War II, their denials about China, all these things. And I'm sure the Germans have their own version of World War II at some point. Probably some are way too liberal, some are way too conservative, whatever the case may be. And in America, the great mythology of America is the American Civil War. Lincoln has his own mythology, and the South has their mythology. And there are people who still try to hold on to what's called the Southern myth, which was started by Jefferson Davis after the war ended. And you hold on to these things because it's a defining aspect. But very often the stories themselves are fabrications, and there's a kernel untruth. There's a kernel in it that's not true, and that's a serious problem because it's always a serious difficulty, in my opinion, for a country to hold on to a myth if that myth is not accurate or represents the truth about a situation. Because it means that their actions will be the result of something that's a lie. And if you act on a lie, very often you act incoherently and irrationally. That's the whole problem the South doesn't see about itself. When it holds on to various aspects of the Southern myth about what the Southerners were really like and what the American Civil War was really about, it makes them appear to be irrational. And that they really aren't willing to sit down and have a rational discussion about what really happened. I don't think this is going to change, but I do think it's very interesting. Trump mentioned this very early in the campaign about 911, but I haven't heard anything about it since. Now, the next thing I want to get to is a question that directly relates to the election, and that is the state of the economy. And I think there were two stories this week that really tell the tale about the problem of anybody running for president and what they face. The one is that we have a situation in Indiana where there are two companies that are run by United Technologies, and they're both going to close down over the course of the next 3 or 4 years, and they're going to send their jobs to Mexico. It supposedly is going to end up costing 2,100 jobs when they're done. One of them is Carrier, makes air conditioners. And the question has to be asked, if you're going to constantly have debates in public arenas, as we have had over the last 4 months, about who's going to fix the economy, is there really anything to do about this? What can be done? Can a president actually stop a company from moving to Mexico? And has the situation changed any since the early 2000s of this 2000 and up, where you have situations now where thousands of jobs and hundreds of factories are moved to another country? What can be done, ultimately be done about it? And it's still going on. And this election apparently hasn't fazed these two companies, because they're going to go ahead and do it. They're not worried about it. It doesn't seem to be anything they're worried about as to who gets elected. They didn't say, you know, well, we can't move because Trump might get elected, or we can't move because Bernie Sanders might get elected. They're not saying any of that. They've just got their plans, and they're getting ready to go. Now, in conjunction with that, we have a very interesting story today about the fact that the state of Louisiana, under a new governor, is declaring the fact that it's broke. And the blame is being put directly on Bobby Jindal, who was a Republican who, if you remember, at one point was attempting to run for president, and it didn't last very long. They have a new governor in Louisiana, Mr. Edwards. And the point I would like to make here is he's doing a lot of what is done in this situation, and I find it really socially fascinating. He claims the state, and the state's got like a $900 million deficit. Some say it's almost a billion. Jindal cooked the book, so to speak. He moved money around in weird ways so he could pay for things, but he never really did it in such a way that he guaranteed a solvency for the future of the state. And so he is getting an awful lot of grief for this. The point I would make here is the governor's threatening to cancel the football at LSU. And this is really right out of every bond issue I've ever seen. The governor wants to raise taxes. That's what he wants to do. He wants to raise taxes. And I've seen this a million times in my lifetime in local high schools. Every time a school district claims that they're going broke and that they need to have the local people vote in a bond issue, they threaten to get rid of the sports. They don't threaten to get rid of the English department or the French department, and they don't threaten to get rid of the acting department, the theater department. They threaten to get rid of the football team. And in the minds of people who run the country and are politicians, there is no better way to get a person to vote for a tax increase than to threaten to not let them watch a football game. And I just think this is absolutely an extraordinary example of how the American mentality works. Once you get into a budget crisis, and once you're in an economic crisis, your priorities are automatically discovered. And in the mind, apparently, of John Bel Edwards, who was the Democratic governor of Louisiana, the mindset is, I'll get a tax increase if I threaten the football team. And it's been done for 50 years. I've seen this my whole life. And you would think at some point that the American mentality would alter. You would think if he got up and said, you know what, if we don't have any money to fund the colleges, we're going to lose the computer departments, we're going to lose all the medical departments, we're going to lose. No, it's the football team. And if, as far as all these jobs going to Mexico, what is the priority of the company? The chairman of the company told the workers at a meeting, don't take, this is right out of The Godfather, don't take this personally. This is strictly a business decision. And what he was telling them is, it has nothing to do with whether you're a good worker or a bad worker or anything you've done. It's just that it's a business decision, and that's the priority. The priority is to make money for the stockholders or whoever runs the company, and the individual workers are sacrificed, so to speak, for the benefit of some other whole and they're not the priority. And this is what you find out. You always find out when things are collapsing what the priorities are. And I think that this Louisiana thing is just wonderful to see. The Democratic governor apparently wants to raise taxes. That's the story. And this is what's happened. The federal government has refused to raise taxes. So who's going to raise them? The states and the localities. It always works that way. If Louisiana can't get enough money from the feds, they'll tax their own citizens. Now, the next topic I'd like to get to here, and I think it's a, I'm just going to mention one thing in passing. Over the weekend and the week, there was this huge amount of screaming and carrying on about the halftime show at the Super Bowl, in which the, and it's interesting, at the in the Super Bowl, the game itself becomes secondary to what goes on around it. And I think this is very, very interesting in American politics. I would argue with you the same is true for the presidential election. We now, almost as a nation, have more interest in the news reporters who are reporting the election than we do the people who are actually running. The news reporters for CNN got more press than Santorum did when he ran for president. And maybe they should have, but on the other hand, that's not how it's supposed to work. But this is what happens now. Rush Limbaugh, arguably, could be argued on a social level, is more important than the people he talks about. Rush Limbaugh may be more important than Barack Obama. And one of the reasons is Barack Obama has to leave in a year, and Rush Limbaugh is still hanging around. He survives the elections. He's always there. And what he says about Barack Obama may be more important, and I'm very serious about this, than anything Barack Obama actually does. What I would like to do, though, as far as the Super Bowl, is talk about the fact that Beyonce, I guess her name really is, the singer, very famous singer, did part of the halftime show. And the story is she had her dancers dance in the garb of the Black Panthers, and it was and they did an X, which was reminiscent of Malcolm X. I'm not going to pass any judgment on it. It's not up to me to do that. But what I would like to point out is a very simple historical fact over the last 50 years. When I was young and the civil rights movement was going on in the 1960s, if you read the articles that were written about it, the most important person in the civil rights movement was Martin Luther King Jr. He was a minister, and he was technically, you could argue, a pacifist. Being a complete pacifist is almost impossible, but he did have peaceful demonstrations, and he preached pacifist movement. And they always compared him to Mahatma Gandhi. But it seems to me over the last 5 years that I have noticed an awful lot that the Black culture of this country has moved away from him to his alternative, and that is Malcolm X. And Malcolm X was looked down upon by a lot of people in the 1960s as the really bad alternative to Martin Luther King Jr. And a lot of Black people said at that time the reason was white people could tolerate a pacifist because he didn't threaten them literally. He didn't point a gun at them. And Malcolm X wasn't a pacifist. And he, if you hear some of his early speeches, he changed over time, I will admit. They advocated a lot of different violent things to do in the minds of a lot of white people and Black people. And my point would be to you that as a historical figure, he was not regarded at all the way that Martin Luther King Jr. was. But I don't hear people talking that much about Martin Luther King Jr. anymore. I've just got this feeling that pacifism is just not something that everybody in the modern world really sees as the answer to a problem. Now, yes, a lot of the Black people in Ferguson and that peacefully protested, and there was not violence. But ultimately, that is not the way things are seen anymore. And I think it's a fascinating thing that a public figure like Beyonce could actually do that And it really wasn't, there were a lot of people that didn't have that bad a reaction to it. They would have had a very bad reaction 50 years ago. The Black Panthers were seen as a, basically, in modern terms, as a terrorist organization at the time. And to advocate a terrorist organization in 1970 would have not gone over very well. But apparently in today's circumstances, we don't see the world the same way. And we're willing to listen to it in a different way than we used to. Now, the last thing I want to bring up here is Syria. And I want to bring it up because supposedly now they're negotiating a ceasefire. And there's this big negotiation where everybody's going around. And then they had a headline today that the Russians and the Americans are saying mean things to each other. And that there's a lot of bad rhetoric between the two and, you know, blah, blah, blah. I would like to tell you, if you are not familiar with this, that this game of ceasefires has been going on in politics, again, for 50 or 60 years. And it's an endless political game that's played, and the game is very, very cynical often and very, very dangerous. All the way back to the 1960s, you would have these various times within a battle zone in which there were supposedly negotiated ceasefires. It happened in the country of Lebanon for years. It would happen in the Middle East, different parts of the Middle East. African countries would do it. You would have negotiated settlements. And I think there was even talk about it in Vietnam on occasion. But the fact, during that horrible war, but the fact of the matter is, what is the point of the ceasefire and why is it being done and to whose benefit is it being done? And I think the real point I want to make here is that there's a standard line that's used in politics about ceasefires, which is a ceasefire doesn't bring peace. A ceasefire is nothing more than a way for everybody to rearm. Now, that's the really cynical way of looking at it. And the thing about it is, Russia is bombing anyway, even though there supposedly is a ceasefire and a truce. But at the same time, I think the real key here is what was raised the other day on a radio show I heard from the BBC. And they said that the key factor on all of this is that Russia is really, they're not messing around. This isn't the kind of thing that Obama announced. Remember, he didn't bomb, at one point in time, he didn't bomb the caravan that was carrying the oil for the Iraqis, ISIS, because he supposedly didn't want to kill the truck drivers or something, and then he didn't want to bomb an oil well because he said it might pollute the surrounding area. The Russians don't play that game. And the Russians have made this game way, way rougher than it was 6 months ago. There are stories from Aleppo and places like that where if the Russians decide to bomb somebody, they bomb them. I mean, it's not, I'm going to blow up this building over here and leave that building alone. It's a lot of destruction, and there's a lot of people getting killed, and the thing is, they're winning, and that's what the British guy said. He said the Americans are really upset because the Russians and the Assyrians in some places are winning, and they don't want them to win. And if we don't want them to win, it means we want variations of ISIS to win, and it places us in a really ugly situation. But I think it's really fascinating that a country in World War II, like America and Britain, that were responsible for the bombing of Dresden and the bombing of Hamburg and the bombing of Tokyo and dropped two nuclear weapons on Japan and killed over 100,000 people, for good or bad, but were willing to do all of that, are all upset at the Russians because they're bombing people. I mean, we dropped more bombs on the country of Laos than we dropped in World War II. We bombed them for 10 years. But now we're mad because they're doing it. This ceasefire is always political theater. It's all theater. But will it really mean anything in the end? If history proves itself to mean anything, I really and seriously doubt it, except that they're just going to make more accusations. My time's up. Thank you very much. Have a great day, and God bless. Bye.